This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor, Gaius, and I welcome Michael Vlahos of Johns Hopkins, Germanicus. As is our custom, we are on the shores of the Thames River. It is 90 AD. It is winter and chilly. However, we have our good cloaks on and we're drinking wine, comfortable. Well served. We don't work. We're equestrian class. Later on, there'll be entertainment for us, and we like to go to bed early on these winter evenings. The sun is not much up above the horizon, and it's a good time to sleep and reflect. We're at the edge of the empire, and our emperor, Domitian, who is not popular with the Senate, is campaigning, always campaigning, somewhere on the Danube. He has legions enough to overwhelm his adversaries, which are generally the tribes. There are many of them. And yet, over these last weeks, we've received reports that Domitian has taken to warning the adversaries, not actually campaigning against the adversaries, drawing lines, either the Danube or somewhere on the other side of the Danube, or it is winter camp time, and he's making these warnings in order to enter into diplomacy back and forth. We will not settle that in our conversations this evening, but because we have the ability to look 2,000 years ahead, we see an instance that reminds us of what we're witnessing between our emperor, he's not popular with the Senate, did I mention that, and Domitian. And this is the emperor in America, one Joe Biden, in conversation with the German princes, in this case, Vladimir Putin and his counselors, about not quite the Danube, but the Black Sea Basin, Ukraine, the Dnieper River Valley, and what is to be done. Germanicus, a very good evening to you. I tell this analogy roughly, about America. Once upon a time, June of 1950, the Secretary of State had made an error in saying what the U.S. would and would not protect following the fall of the Japanese Empire. And the North Koreans, led by Kim Il-sung, took this as a go signal to cross into South Korea and take it all, take Seoul, launched the attack, sneak attack, June of 1950, overran the South Korean forces, the ROK, the ROKs. The counterattack started from Busan at the base of the peninsula. In September, MacArthur engineered a brilliant plan to land at Incheon with the U.S. 1st Marine Division, which had been hastily reconstituted after the war. It had all been in pieces, as was the 12-million-man army, down to about a million at the time, all over the earth, chiefly in Europe. Well, Seoul was retaken by the Marines, and then there was a decision made to cross the 38th parallel, which had been the demarcation between North Korea, the communist North Korea, and South Korea, the dictatorship of the South Korea, and move on against the panicky North Korean army and roll up right to the Yalu River, which is the line between North Korea and China at the time. It is now mid-November 1950, and everyone is expecting that the troops will be home by Christmas. We'll wrap this up, and then all of Korea will be liberated. The American people are waiting for good news from MacArthur. I add this, Germanicus. We know what happened next was a catastrophe, the absolute catastrophe of a Chinese-launched attack, maybe up to a 500,000 Chinese soldiers. 2 out of 3 were armed. The others were just for cannon fodder, to pick up a weapon on the field from their fallen comrades. Threw themselves at the 8th Army and at the U.S. Marines on the East Coast and overwhelmed the Americans. It was a massacre. I mention this because right now the Russian army is deployed on the other side of the Dnieper and on the other side of Ukraine and is threatening to overwhelm what remains of the Ukrainian army. And the American response is talk, talk, talk. I won't say it'll be over for Christmas. It has been Christmas. But it reminds me very much that when you talk of victory, you get surprised. What does Korea mean to you, Germanicus, given that we're watching the deployed Russian army, overwhelming Russian army, and the Emperor of the Russians, Mr. Putin, is making threats. Good evening to you.
Good evening, guys. And this is a key metaphor, almost a parable, for what's wrong with American strategic thought. The example of Korea is, or I should say, should be, a beacon to us. It's taught in the Naval War College. I would teach Korea every year. And what began to come through to me was the fact that what we call the retreat from Incheon was actually the first great defeat of the American army in a campaign since the Battle of Fredericksburg in 1862. It was a terrible blow to a nation that had defeated not just Japan, but also Germany, the Nazi Reich. And here we were being thrown back all the way down the peninsula past Seoul, which we lost, by a ragtag army in sneakers that wouldn't let casualties, their own casualties, stop them. And so in the end, yeah, we killed maybe 500,000 in the course of the Korean conflict or more Chinese soldiers. And yet we couldn't come out of Korea with anything more than a stalemate. Now, Korea is useful because it incorporated a kind of back and forth rhythm to the war in which one side would undertake an offensive, it would culminate, which means it would reach its natural end point of energy, and then there would be a counteroffensive, and the other side would be pushed back in the same manner. And this ebb and flow led to a kind of a stalled war to which there was no ultimate solution. And of course, the war is still, as it were, on the books today. There's been a longstanding ceasefire, but the Koreas are still at war officially. And by definition, and people should think about this, so too are China and the United States. And maybe that would give us some pause if we were to look at that. And what Russia is trying to do here, since it can't simply conquer Ukraine, is to create a situation in which they will impose a rhythm of conflict that over time disheartens their opponent. Not merely their opponent, in front of them, which is, of course, Ukraine, but their bigger opponent here strategically, which is, of course, the United States and all of NATO. And it is it cannot be denied that NATO has been on a strategic offensive against the former Soviet Union, which succeeded the former Russian Empire. And in effect, the NATO, which is a stand in itself for the United Europe of the Nazi Reich, or more pertinently, perhaps the Central Powers of World War I, which defeated Russia and imposed a humiliating a peace settlement called the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, in which essentially Ukraine and the Baltics were ceded to Germany. And this is something that I am sure runs through the minds of Russian strategists and Mr. Putin himself, who knows very well that were Ukraine to become a part of NATO, it would be the end of Russia as power. And so what does Russia have to do short of conquering Ukraine and risking a general war with NATO? What can it do to keep Ukraine from drifting into the NATO sphere? Well, one thing it can do is what it's already done, occupying parts of Ukraine and thus creating an ongoing security situation in which it's impossible under current NATO rules for accession into the alliance, makes it impossible for Ukraine to be considered as a potential member as long as this situation continues. So clearly, it's going to continue potentially forever. That's the first step in the strategy. The second step in the strategy is to take back a part of Ukraine that is indisputably Russian, which, of course, is Crimea. And because Crimea had been gifted, as it were, to Ukraine in 1956 by the then premier Nikita Khrushchev, it was seen as something that had not been given to Ukraine for any serious legitimate reason and was still Russian. And under those circumstances, retaking Crimea and having it ratified by a plebiscite put Ukraine on notice that it was more Ukraine than the Ukraine. In other words, Ukraine means borderlands, and its borders are and have been throughout history shifting borders. So what Russia was saying in part two of the strategy was, hey, these borders can shift, and if you don't watch it, they will, and you will be disadvantaged by that shift. You'll be made smaller and more dependent on us and less secure in the future if you continue to move toward NATO and the European Union. And the third part of the strategy is what Americans, in their strategic opacity, describe incorrectly as frozen war. It's not frozen at all. What's happened is the same kind of rhythm of offensives and pullbacks and new offensives that you saw unfold in Korea over the 3 years of that war. So what happened is the Russians initially promoted, certainly encouraged, and then supported these breakaway Russian, pro-Russian republics in Donetsk and Luhansk. When Ukraine undertook a counteroffensive to take them back, Russia put forces in, more green men, except not in Crimea, but this time directly into the Donbas. And they not only pushed Ukrainian forces back, they savagely defeated them. And had they not been called back, they could easily have taken, say, Mariupol or Kharkov and moved the goalposts much deeper into Ukraine and into parts that were still predominantly Russian-speaking and thus part of the Russian claim if it wished to partition Ukraine. But it doesn't, because a partition of Ukraine would mean that the parts of the former Ukraine that were not titularly Russian would be part of NATO. So they don't want a solution like that. A partition would mean a settlement. What Russia wants is to continue to have this back and forth. And what is so seriously worrisome about the current buildup of Russian forces is that it isn't simply an intimidation. It could mean another intimidating offensive. In other words, a very short campaign in which more key territory like Mariupol or Kharkiv would put rock Ukraine on its heels. And it would, as you suggested a few minutes ago, be an opportunity to destroy the main standing forces of the Ukrainian military, which are all forward, just like the Soviet Red Army was forward when Hitler launched Barbarossa, and thus the entire standing Soviet army was destroyed within weeks. So it could be suggested that the standing Ukrainian army could be destroyed, captured within days.
And my Germanicus, I mentioned you trigger my thought, because South Korea knew there was a threat in the summer, coming the summer of 1950. Mm-hmm. But the U.S., its State Department, the president, Mr. Truman, did not believe the North Koreans would attack. They didn't believe
it. We did the worst of both worlds. In other words, we didn't believe it, but we put in the infamous Task Force Smith, a tiny group of American forces, and thought, oh, we're making a statement. this will certainly deter, you know, North Korea from attacking, because if they attack, they're going to get into a war while they attacked. And this is part of the problem with American thinking. Today, I've read several establishment commentaries that say, we must be tough with Mr. Putin. We must show our resolve. And that means giving more arms to Ukraine and doing this and that. And of course, rather than showing resolve, what it does is it insinuates in the mind of Mr. Putin the conviction, the conclusion, the judgment that, hey, I've got to do something bigger than this, or they're just going to keep it up. They're not going to stop. And they don't understand how serious I am about an outcome that does not disadvantage the Russian Federation. And the thing about, I've also read about different war scenarios that are bruited about here in the Imperial City, and they're not very convincing war scenarios. The convincing war scenario is similar in its approach and goals to the earlier incursions of the Russian army, meaning it takes territory that would dishearten not just Ukraine, but NATO, and let them know, hey, we could take the whole of Ukraine, or we could take the whole of Novorossiya, which is all of the southern part of Ukraine that was understood to be part of the Russian Empire. And the fact is that the Russians probably wouldn't stay after having defeated the frontal forces.
Well, they didn't stay in 2014. They surrounded what was thrown out there by Ukrainians, destroyed them in completely. They surrounded them and destroyed them and then left.
Yeah, after Debaltseve?
The confidence of the Biden administration that Russia won't attack is astonishing to me. Why do they think this? The president was vice president in 2014. They also didn't believe Russia would attack. When the little men showed up, they were shocked.
Well, Russia doesn't have to attack as long as it is achieving its intimidation goals. But if it doesn't attack for too long, it looks like a paper tiger, and therefore no one will take it seriously. So something has to happen. Either the U.S. has to accede to the main outline of the settlement, which has to do with Ukraine. The part on the Baltics is different. And the fact is, when the Soviet Union was created, the Baltics were not part of the Soviet Union. This is extremely important. The Baltics were occupied by Stalin. So the Baltics do not impinge on any treaty with Russia today that is truly focused on Georgia and Ukraine. It's not a bridge too far, but we have to step up to understanding Putin's bottom line here, or if you want to use the cliche, his red lines. And the fact is, there are many military options that would work superbly for Mr. Putin, and there are no military options for the United States and NATO. There is nothing that NATO or the United States can do with its military forces.
Let me read from the report from the White House as we wait for more from Mr. Putin. The talks are said to be beginning January 10th, led on the U.S. side by Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman. And on the Russian side, we can believe Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, will lead their talks. But the White House says Mr. Biden, quote, laid out two paths, end quote. Quote, one is a path of diplomacy, and the other path is more focused on deterrence, including serious costs. Michael, that's it. That's it. The downside for Putin to take what he wants is serious costs. That's it.
Right. And because of the peculiar fantasy world that Washington inhabits regarding how others regard it, the assumptions within the Washington establishment, policy establishment, the assumptions are that they take us very seriously, and all we have to do is threatened, and they'll back off. We have to show resolve, and they'll back off. And in fact, I think a very different calculation exists among them, especially Mr. Putin, and that they are not in the least intimidated by us now. Now, they may be wrong. If we were to react by going to war with Russia, yes, then Mr. Putin would have made a poor a choice. But the fact is that he may have our number. He may know exactly where we stand at this point of immobilization in our national life and in the state of our defenses and in the level of our resolve, which is very low. And if that is the case, then this is an option that he has, that he can take in the next month or two, if the United States does not get serious about walking this whole thing down, you know, walking it back.
I'll leave this with Korean War. Thank you, Germanicus. This is Gaius and Germanicus. We're going to wander off to the amphitheater now, but this is a report from the George Marshall Foundation about what happened October 1st, 1950. Mr. MacArthur, General MacArthur, made a decision within his remit and military ethos. MacArthur's pursuit of the retreating North Korean forces across the 38th parallel, the border between the two Koreas, was one that made perfect sense in many ways. MacArthur's drive to destroy the North Koreans, however, exceeded the mandate of his United Nations sanctions authority, and his move north brought U.S. troops forced to within miles of mainland China. This drew the Chinese into what had been largely a local conflict, albeit one with significant Cold War considerations. George Marshall, at this point, was serving as Secretary of Defense and had been in office just a few weeks. MacArthur's pursuit of a beaten enemy and pursuit of total victory was entirely consistent with his military experience, especially against the Japanese. It ended, as Michael said, with the destruction of not one but two American forces moving up the east and west side of the peninsula. And it is now, what is it now, Michael? 71 years.
Yes.
And that war continues. So mm-hmm. A mistake in Ukraine, 71 years from now, it's possible, Michael, 71 years from now, it would still be the scar in the Black Sea. We'll continue.
Right.
Germanicus and Gaius, wandering off to the amphitheater, more entertainment from the Greeks who preach virtue. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.